hologram. Pasta Jolene and Dexon to adjust course toward this zone, starward from C1, and form a dense hemisphere to intercept. Helm, take us here at all possible speed. Engels's comm team sent her orders over the relay system. Returns from the network updated the hologram in real time, and she watched as Jolene moved his local task force to plant itself directly between C1 and its star. It occurred to her that if Braga were really clever, he'd try to follow the curving streamer of gas that extended from Calypso to the planet. She didn't have stealth sensors there. "Tell Jolene to shift position to make it harder for Braga to turn and dive back into the streamer," she ordered. "Dexon can cover the other angle with his lights." Jolene's monitor didn't move, but he slid the rest of his ships sideward to flank it, making any Hun turn toward the gas ribbon a costly one. Dexon's light fleet continued to decelerate furiously. The computer predicted its resting point farther out from Jolene's ships and behind them, in a position to backstop them. The lights continued to emit their fake dreadnought signatures. Until Braga got solid visuals, he'd believe he faced an overwhelming force. Now came the frustration of flag rank as Engels watched her forces interpret her orders while her own vessel was out of firing range. She wanted to reach into the hologram and adjust the positions of ships to their most efficient fleet configurations, but micromanagement would do more harm than good. She had confidence in the older, more experienced Dexon, but she'd appointed Jolene as squadron commander based on his trustworthiness, not tactical depth. Less than a year ago, he'd been a mere frigate captain. Then again, she herself was just a jumped-up gunship pilot. She wished she'd been able to bring along Ellen Gray, but she also needed an experienced hand to run the home fleet, and incidentally to guard the Liberation from getting hijacked by former Mutuality politicians and bureaucrats. Wishes, fishes. The moment of truth approached. The hologram showed Braga's core fleet speeding low around the giant gas planet, adjusting course as they flew. Any minute now, she'd see whether she'd guessed right. If not, this might turn into a long, running chase of attrition. She'd still win. She'd already won. But the crushing victory she craved might elude her. There. Braga's fleet made its move to break out of its skimming partial orbit. Engines flared at maximum, and his ships rose as one in a smooth curve that dead-ended at the exit point closest to the star, exactly where she hoped. As Braga broke out of the nebula and Jolene's command ambushed him, Engels breathed a sigh of relief. She sat up and straightened her dress jacket, worn deliberately for this moment. "Comms? Record a new message. Vidlink when ready. Recording. Admiral Lucas Braga, this is Admiral Carla Engels." Braga realized he'd failed to outguess the enemy when he saw the Hawk monitor loom in front of him. He watched in horror as the huge ship fired her cluster of primary lasers, ripping the last of his super dreadnoughts, save only his flagship, to shreds, at point-blank range. Had they spared his flagship because they knew it was the commanding vessel? Or was it mere luck? He'd been outguessed so badly, it couldn't be luck. He didn't need to order return fire. All of his ships had been given leave to engage, and they unleashed a storm of railguns shots, missiles and beam weapons, lasers, masers, particle beams, any raw destructive energy that could be focused and sent toward an enemy. The 9 closest heavy cruisers quickly broke, smashed, or driven back, and the super dreadnought he faced slid closer to the monitor for mutual support even as it gave and received furious blows. A terrifying blizzard came back at him, and in his hollow tank his ships began to turn shades of yellow and red, as their capabilities were methodically stripped from them, though less so than he might have expected. In fact, the many capital ships backing up the enemy monitor, the ones that had transited in behind Braga, seemed to be withholding the worst of it, only engaging with lighter weapons. Yet he was outmatched, outgunned, and outtunned. Though he was proud of how his ships fought, his first duty was to get them out of this new trap. "Hard to starboard, 30 degrees angle toward the gas streamer," he snapped. Give them more deflection and try to get back into concealment. They can't have sensors everywhere. But the Hawk fleets moved to block him, to stay with him. There was simply nowhere to go, and though he was moving fast, he didn't have enough velocity to simply flash past and outrun them. "Admiral," Lexan spoke up, "I believe I know why the fire from the enemy-backing fleet is so light. It appears they have no ships heavier than a light cruiser." "But the display shows dreadnoughts, I know. They appear to be using spoofing emitters more sophisticated than any I've ever seen. Alien technology, perhaps. However, in empty space, optical scanners clearly show these ships are of escort class." "Those bastards. Those clever fucking bastards." Braga straightened. "Your pardon." Lexan chuckled, as did a couple other of those within earshot. "I believe threat of death merits the occasional burst of vulgar language, though why you believe the enemy were born out of wedlock I don't know." "I was briefed," Braga deadpanned. He sighed and rubbed his temples. "Will we make it out?" "My analysis says some of us will," Lexan replied. Just then, Luxembourg shuddered and the power feeds flickered. "The monitors targeting us." "Full reinforcement," Captain Verdura said.
"At full, ma'am," replied the defense chief.
"I'm getting shorted power for evasives," the helm complained. "Go to emergency power on the reactors, divert from life support, seal suits as needed." Braga fought furiously, looking for any way out. There seemed none. Yes, because of the enemy's light unit fake-out, more of his fleet would get past the monitor to dive into the gas streamer. But the Hawk ships would immediately turn and stern rake him. Then those 200 light units would harry him all the way to Calypso and around, and he'd eventually run out of plasma to hide in. He'd be lucky to get 10 ships to flat space and transit out, and there was no guarantee his flagship would be among them. "Admiral, incoming transmission from the enemy, full vid, with a vid link request."
"Play it," Braga ordered.
"But don't halt operations." The hollow tank moved its display far enough out of the way to give Braga easy view of the leftmost of three main hollow screens. On it, a young, half-familiar human woman with the broad stripes of an admiral appeared, seated in a command chair.
"Admiral Lucas Braga, this is Admiral Carla Engels. I'm recording this in hopes you'll accept a truce and talk to me about an honorable surrender. If not, I'm going to have to break you, ship by ship, until each one strikes her colors or is utterly crippled. I don't want that, and I don't think you do either. Please accept the vidlink. As soon as you do, I'll order my fleet to stand down, and I would expect you to do the same. If you don't like what I have to say, well..."
The stern young woman leaned forward to stand, clasping her hands behind her back.
"I'll regretfully order your annihilation."
10 seconds went by, then 20, as the bridge crew continued to pass orders and information in a glut of controlled confusion. Even as Braga watched, two more of his ships turned red and ceased to fight. One of the enemy vessels did too, but he simply couldn't see any way to disagree with Engels' assessment. Braga took a deep breath. "Accept the vidlink. Cease offensive fire, all ships. Maintain point defense fire, maximum evasion, and maximum armor reinforcement." In the moment available, he used his brain chips to perform a search for the name Carla Engels. A military record came up. 100 worlds military record. As his fleet's fire slackened, and then the enemy's, the image on the screen jerked and changed slightly. It now showed Admiral Engels in real time as she ceased pacing behind her chair to place her hands on its tall back and stare into the vid pickup.
"Greetings, Admiral Braga."
"I won't say hail and well met, Miss Engels."
"Admiral Engels."
"I knew your name seemed familiar. You served under me at Corinth and were captured by the Hawk there, we thought. I can hardly credit you with making flag rank in less than 2 years, even if I regarded whatever traitorous regime you serve as legitimate."
Engels arched an eyebrow.
Your people are dying, and you're concerned with my title? You always did have a stick up your ass, Zaxby once told me.
Zaxby? Captain Verdura stepped into the vid's view.
Zaxby the Ruxin? Of course. He joined me when Derek Straker and I broke out of a mutuality prison and started the liberation. A hawk prison, you'd say.
I'd like to see Zaxby, Verdura said.
That can wait, Braga snapped.
Sir,
Verdura said, turning away from the vid and giving the comtech a throat-cutting motion to pause the link.
I don't know Engels, but Zaxby served with me for nearly 3 years. If they can produce him, if we can see him in the flesh, we'd have a non-hawk, non-human that I know personally. We might get a better read on this whole situation.
Braga stroked his jowls. There does seem to be something fundamentally off. For example, where are the hawk? All Engels's bridge crew look either human or Ruxin.
That could be a hollow fabrication or just a setup. But more than anything, we need information. From a source they might not be expecting us to talk to, like Zaxby.
Nodding to Verdura, Braga signaled to resume the vidlink.
We want to see Zaxby, in person. I also need those vessels of mine that haven't surrendered to join my flagship.
Of course, Admiral.
Engels turned and issued orders to her staff.
And I'll be joining you on my own flagship. Do you have holographic conferencing capability?
Of course.
Then I suggest you set up a meeting in your flag conference room, unencrypted. My senior staff and I will attend via HoloLink, and Zaxby will join you in person as you request.
What about the hawk? Verdura snarled. Engels seemed briefly surprised.
What about them? Oh, yes. You still think they're in charge, like I used to. And I bet you still think they're aliens, too.
She chuckled.
This will be an interesting meeting. Engels out.
What the hell did she mean? Said Verdura. I suppose we'll soon see, Braga replied.
A destroyer is approaching at high speed from astern, said Lexan. She identifies as the new Earthid Republic ship Tridity and requests docking for Zaxby to come aboard.
Lock her up with targeting. Be ready for a suicide launch, said Verdura. Tell them no to docking, remain at 5 kilometers range, and send a shuttle.
She is slowing, Lexan said. I have never seen a destroyer this fast. She maneuvers like a corvette. She has come to relative rest at a range of 5,000.003 meters. Her pilot is amazingly precise. He must be Ruxin.
While all this was happening, Braga's own stragglers took up station. The enemy fleet also closed in, aiming their weapons from ragged formations. Braga sniffed at their lack of military discipline, but that wouldn't matter given their numbers. If the fight resumed, Engels would no doubt make good on her threats. Braga saw a shuttle icon separate itself from the destroyer and speed over to dock with Luxembourg.
Have a marine detail meet that shuttle and bring Zaxby and anyone else who debarks to the flag conference room. Make sure to do a thorough body scan.
He nodded to Verdura and then headed for the meeting as her XO took the con. In the command conference room, Braga and his staff didn't have long to wait. The marine detail escorted a Ruxin in, and the major in charge set a slim headset on the table in front of his admiral.
Other than this water suit, this is all he had on him, sir.
Braga picked up the device, some kind of highly sophisticated comlink, clearly made to plug directly into Zaxby's brain chips. Unusual, but hardly unknown. He then turned his attention to the Ruxin. Verdura had already walked over to Zaxby and inspected him at close range.
Something looks different about you.
She turned to the Ruxin tech in the room who was setting up the vid conference with the enemy.
You, what's your name?
Senior Technician Bexall, ma'am.
Bring up records of Zaxby and compare them to this Ruxin. Tell me what your Ruxin eyes see.
The tech quickly examined Zaxby's service record while the prisoner, the envoy, she supposed, waited patiently.
At first glance, it appears to be Zaxby, Bexall said.
However, in my estimation, this person is too young.
Verdura turned to the impostor and snarled, Who the hell are you, then? And what's your game?
I am Zaxby, Captain Verdura. Though I've undergone an initial rejuvenation procedure, I will allow for your skepticism. But were we not adversaries in this matter, I would be hurt. I served under you for more than 2 years.
He sure sounds like Zaxby, she said to Braga with a scowl. But I know Ruxans can change their skin color, and they're smart.
I'd be happy to submit to a genetic test. I'm sure you have my profile.
Send up a med tech with a scanner, Braga said. In the meantime, let's get this conference going.
Bexall made final adjustments, and holograms flickered to life. Engels, a dark-haired man in a captain's tunic, and a startlingly large Ruxan. Engels spoke, gesturing first at the octopoid, then the human.
This is Commodore Dexon, commanding my light units, and this is Captain Jolin, in charge of the Monitor and Defense Squadron.
Admiral, Bexall said suddenly, flustered. Your pardon for the interruption. That is a war mail.
What the hell is a war mail? Said Verdura.
A biologically specialized male of my species, hormonally modified to be a warrior and commander. I've never seen one before. That's one more oddity to add to the pile, but let's not get off track here, said Braga. Fine. I see two humans and a Ruxan. Where's the Hawk in charge?
Engels growled and seemed to stifle an eye roll.
Admiral, this may be difficult for you to accept at first, but there is no Hawk in charge. There never was, were, whatever.
She gestured, and something stepped into the hollow vidlink, appearing in full VR. A Hawk. It reminded Braga of a human-shaped, bumpy-skinned lizard. He stood involuntarily at the virtual threat, before his mind overrode the impulse, and he relaxed.
I knew it.
This is Sergeant Green 53, said Engels. Sergeant, say hello to the Admiral.
Hello, Admiral.
Stand on your hands.
The Hawk immediately performed a perfect handstand and stayed that way. Engels smiled.
Does this Hawk look like he's in charge?
This could be a setup, Verdura hissed. Yes, Captain Verdura, it could be, Zaxby said unexpectedly. But it's not.
The Ruxan gestured at the medical technician who had slipped into the room, scanner in hand. Everyone watched as the scan was performed. The tech handed Braga the scanner to read.
It matches, the Admiral muttered. This really is Zaxby.
In the flesh, Zaxby said. And the Hawk are not in charge. We are. Humans, Ruxans, and several other minor species who live within the Republic.
You've been brainwashed, Verdura said.
I assure you no, quite the contrary, actually.
Look, Engels said. We could be fooling you, but what would be the point?
To get us to surrender, Braga said. I'm sure you'd like to take these ships intact.
I would, Engels replied with a quirk of a smile. But I don't need to.
Admiral,
Lexan's voice broke in from his bridge station as a screen flickered to life.
Forgive the interruption, but there's a ship. A ship has emerged from the nebula. Big. Bigger.
The sensor's officer seemed at a loss for words. Engels stepped toward Braga, capturing his attention.
It appears you've detected Indomitable. Take your time. You need to know what you're up against.
Lexan explained what Braga was seeing on the screen.
Sir, the enemy ship is impossible. It's 4 times the size of a monitor, 16 times the size of the largest super dreadnought, with spinal weapons to match. It's a mobile fortress. It must have been what smashed our SDNs, what we thought was a fortress. Fortresses.
So what? Braga snapped, hiding his consternation.
You have a big ship. I know you mouse-trapped us. But you must have stripped 200 planets up and down the front to do it. That means everywhere else the 100 worlds will be seizing territory unopposed. I'm a military man, Engels. I'm willing to pay the price of war's fortunes.
Engels pressed her lips together earnestly.
Tough words, and admirable. But are you willing that everyone under your command pay that price for nothing?
Not for nothing, said Braga. We took out the fuel factory. Mission accomplished.
Engels shook her head. Sorry, Lucas. All you destroyed was a bunch of decoy emitters placed on a big asteroid. Felicity Station is still intact. Here's a real-time feed.
One of the conference room's screens lit up to show the facility, apparently undamaged, with the current timestamp displayed on the vidlink.
I held off on smashing your flagship, she continued, because I wanted to make sure I had a commander to talk to. But if you're too stubborn, I can turn Luxembourg into scrap with one order. Then I'll negotiate with whoever's next in your chain of command. How's that going to serve your people?
Braga breathed out a defeated sigh.
Give me a couple minutes to confer.
He gestured to pause the conference link and turned to Verdura.
Well?
Verdura slammed her hand onto the table.
My gut says fight, but...
Yes, but... We've apparently failed to destroy their fuel factory, and we've lost this battle. Now all we would do is sacrifice our lives in order to deny them our ships. I can't ask my crews to do that. After centuries of fighting, we're finally winning the war, even if we lost this battle. If these people have any honor at all, they'll intern us and eventually repatriate us.
Verdura looked around the room, and so did Braga, trying to gauge the mood. He saw sober nods and downcast looks, but no disagreement. When the link unpaused, Braga spoke again.
All right, Admiral Engels. I'll agree to a truce, and if you can prove your claims, I'll surrender my forces. That is my decision and mine alone. If you fooled me, if this is some hawk trick, I swear to God I'll never rest until you're brought low.
Engels shrugged. If I fooled you, it's a ruse of war, Admiral, but soon you'll see all the evidence. Your government, the government I served as well, has lied to you, Lucas. It couldn't admit the truth even to its flag officers. Only your most senior politicians and intelligence officials know. You haven't been fighting aliens for those centuries. You've been fighting humans.
She rubbed her eyes and looked away as if sorrowful.
This has been nothing but one massive civil war. And if what I suspect is right, we've been dancing to the tune of aliens the whole time.
Chapter 12 Straker on Terra Nova. Straker slipped carefully out of Doris's bed, letting her sleep. Whatever passed for security services on Terra Nova would soon be connecting the dots and coming to her apartment, and he had to get away. He looked around for anything that might be useful, and settled for a small hand light, a kitchen knife, and a metal strut he pulled off her lone chair. He searched his pockets and found nothing there. They must have taken everything from him when they stunned him. After gazing at Doris one last time, wishing things could be different, he slipped out of her room. A woman in the hallway glanced incuriously at him as Straker passed by and descended the stairs. As he approached the main building door, he saw several ground cars speeding in, lights flashing red in the falling night.
Damn it, there must be a back door.
He turned and hurried toward the rear of the building and found his way into a courtyard. He crossed it and vaulted a shoulder-high wall into a parking lot. Behind him, he heard booted feet on the pavement as the security forces surrounded Doris's building. He ducked his head and didn't look back.
Where to go?
He wondered as he walked quickly around the next building and out of sight. Though this seemed like any human city, he knew nothing about it. He had no money or credit sticks, no identification. He was a fugitive and would have to think like one. He wasn't even certain if this Glasgow place was a diz or not. And what had happened to Don? Was he being interrogated? Did he waive his credentials and go free? If so, was he unable to free Straker? Or was he even now watching to see what his protege
would do. No matter. Straker would run and hide and figure out a way to either rejoin Don or get back to human space on his own. His tweaked biology should be enough to make it past routine scans, and there was always theft or force. No matter what Don had said about the Opters not being at war with humanity, Straker figured he was in his own war with the Sarmak Queens. That meant his options were completely open. With no idea where to go, he chose a direction and began walking. Fortunately, the streets were laid out in a simple grid pattern. Vehicles sped by, though traffic was light. He caught a break when he found a rack full of bicycles. There were no locks, so either crime was unknown here, or the bikes were shared, there for the riding. Soon he was pumping along at 30 or 40 kilometers per hour. This ought to get him somewhere soon. Half an hour later, he ran into a barrier similar to the others he'd seen, 100-meter-high wall that separated Diz from Diz, or Diz from the real populace. If it was like others, the wall would be thick to hold rooms and corridors and facilities where the controllers worked. Other than by taking a train or ground car tunnel, or perhaps an air car, doors in these walls were the only way from one place to another. He couldn't read the Opter writing on the door, but the sensor pad next to it beckoned. Dare he put his palm on it to see if Don had given him access? But any security service worth its salt would have programmed the system to alert them even as it locked Straker out. He leaned his bicycle against the wall of the nearest high-rise and lifted his head to stare upward. The apartment block looked to be about the same height as the wall. Probably the controllers of the system didn't want people looking out their windows at the next place over, acquiring unauthorized information or learning things before they were supposed to. The gap between the top of the wall and the roof of the building looked to be at about 20 meters wide. That would be quite a jump, even if he had a running start off the roof and could be sure of grabbing the top of the wall. Would there be razor wire or other deterrents to crossing? Only one way to find out. Straker headed for the building entrance. Struck by a sudden inspiration, he quickly went back and retrieved the bicycle. He then waited until a resident palmed open the building's front door, and he rushed up before it closed. Nodding to the female facet, who was quite similar to Doris in her innocent demeanor, he lifted the bike to his shoulder and carried it quickly up the stairs. He hoped this action would be unworthy of reporting, or at least that it wouldn't necessarily be connected with his escape. 30 floors later, he reached the very top of the stairs. His superb physical conditioning meant he was barely breathing hard. A door confronted him, with more writing and a red band across it. Logically, this would access the roof. He kicked it open. No alarm blared, though there might be some silent alert. Or perhaps misbehavior in this place was so unusual they hadn't bothered to wire it. Straker bolted quickly inside and shut the door, and then ran up 2 more flights of stairs and debouched onto the roof. The view from the top was magnificent, like any cityscape at night. The lights outlined the buildings and boulevards, and he could see antennas and towers. Illuminated helidrones and air cars created a fairyland that seemed to promise more than it could deliver. Flashing red lights about a kilometer off on the ground reminded him that he was still the prey in a hunt. If they located him up here, no doubt they'd send aircraft. He crossed to the other side of the square roof. The sheer wall extended left and right. He could see nothing across it, not even the glow of other high-rises. No antennas, no towers, no air vehicles. Whatever was over there, it was not a cityscape like this one. Maybe it was farmland, or a park, or even a lake. Squinting, he tried to examine the top of the wall. It was unmarked by lights or glow strips. He could barely see its edge outlined against the fading night sky. Then he remembered the hand light. He clicked it on and shone it across the gap. The top looked clear of obstacles, about 10 meters wide and dead flat. As long as it was dry concrete and not, say, coated with slick paint, he might be able to grab its edge at the end of a jump. But could he make the distance? He stepped up on the low parapet and tried to get a feeling for it. If he sprinted and used the step to launch himself across, he imagined his leap and his trajectory arc and concluded it was very unlikely. Even if he jumped perfectly and aimed to catch the edge of the wall with his hands, he probably wouldn't make it. There was nothing below to grasp either, no ladder, no projections, nothing but a smooth, concrete wall. If he'd had climbing claws or a rope with a grappling hook, he'd have a much better chance, but where could he get such things? Even if he broke into apartments and robbed residents, would they be likely to own devices like that? No. Straker ran from side to side on the roof. He surveyed nearby buildings, trying to see if any were higher or closer to the wall, or situated in any way that might give him an advantage and get him over. Something with a tower or antenna, perhaps with extra altitude or guy wires he could commandeer, or maybe even topple over to form a bridge would be perfect. But there were no structures atop buildings near the wall, perhaps deliberately so. Everything seemed designed to make sure nobody crossed into a new Diz without permission. This left his long-shot inspiration. The bike. It was a desperate, insane idea. He considered it only because he knew his own capabilities, his strength, his speed, his balance. If he could grasp something on the wall with even one hand, he could lift himself. He could ride the bike faster than he could run, and so launch himself across the gap he couldn't jump. The hard part would be arcing across at the correct angle to hit the top of the wall, not fall short, not fly over. 100-meter drop would leave him a broken wreck on the pavement, even if it didn't kill him outright. As he turned to survey the roof with its usual collection of vents, air conditioning machinery, and other unknown devices, he saw three air vehicles traveling in formation approaching from over the city. Had they not been flying together and symmetrically, he might not have noticed them. He ran to the edge of the roof and swore at what he saw. Security force ground cars were approaching his building, their emergency lights spinning and flashing. No time. No time. Only one chance. Straker ran to the small structure housing the stairs' roof access and pried the metal door off its hinges, using a combination of the kitchen knife and the metal strut he'd taken from Doris. He then carried the flat rectangle to the edge of the roof and set it against the parapet at the corner to form a ramp. He chose the corner because he wanted to give himself a 45-degree angle, the better to reach the top of the wall as he landed. Aiming straight at it would make for less room for error. Straker ran for the bicycle and carried it to a spot with a clear path to the ramp. The air vehicles were close, and he could hear the shouts of those on the ground as they piled out of their vehicles. "Now or never, Assault Captain Straker," he told himself sternly as he jumped on the bike and gathered speed. He'd done far more lethal and dangerous things in a mech suit, but now he felt naked with nothing between him and impact, a fall, and capture. The screaming of turbines told him the air cars were close, decelerating to hover or land on the roof. He hoped they weren't allowed to cross the wall. If they were, maybe there was terrain on the other side he could lose himself in. The ramp. The ramp. His tires slammed into it, and he shot upward. Going airborne reminded him of a combat drop. His mind kicked into overdrive, and the world seemed to slow as he flew above the gap. Slugs ricocheted off the wall as he landed, a generous term for his sprawling fall, atop the barrier. His front tire came down flat, but his back tire didn't make it, and the bike bucked him over the handlebars. Desperately, he flattened himself and reached for the concrete surface, hoping it wasn't covered in years of bird shit and dust. Did they bother to clean it? Skin ripped from his palms and forearms as he skidded. He somersaulted to his feet, finding the roof of the wall clean enough for traction. More shots struck near him as the bicycle fell back onto the Glasgow side. There was no cover, and only one place to go. Straker dove for the opposite far edge and slid over, hanging by his right-hand fingers and right toe in order to minimize his profile. Below, on the other side, he could faintly see a forested landscape with no lights. As this world had no moon, he didn't even have reflected shine to help him. Directly below him, he got the impression of trees. The slugs sought his exposed hand and foot, shattering concrete spray from the top of the wall. He had no choice. He twisted and braced, and then let go, shoving off the wall to ensure he fell into the trees. If they were tall and thick with branches, he might survive without breaking bones. If not, he might live, only to be crippled. He pulled his arms tight to his torso and rolled in the air, to present his back to the branches as he'd been taught for parachuting. This kept vulnerable parts of his body, his throat, his armpits, and inner thighs, where the large arteries were, away from puncture. He closed his eyes, covered his face with his hands, and tried to relax. Stiffening up would only make it worse. He crashed through ever-increasing branch sizes, which flayed his clothes and the skin of his back, until he finally impacted one that wouldn't yield to his momentum. It struck him across the legs, spinning him to slam into the next and the next. Now he flailed, trying to regain control. He bounced from a big limb face first, and he could feel ribs crack before he slid off. Straker pinballed off two more, bruising himself painfully before he crashed into the ground, knocking the wind out of him. He struggled to breathe as his diaphragm spasmed and his cracked ribs protested. Staring upward into the branches, he tried to tell if the air cars were coming over the wall. He didn't see lights, didn't hear the turbines searching for him. Despite the battering he'd suffered, he counted it as a win. If the security troops were local to Glasgow, or if this Diz was protected from interference, at least he might get away. Straker was still hazy on the capricious rules the controllers used, but some chance was better than no chance at all. Once he could breathe, he rolled to his knees and stumbled to his feet. He still had the hand light in his pocket, but he thought it better to try to let his eyes adjust to the darkness. The light would pinpoint him for searchers or any hostile denizens of this place. On the other hand, if there was predatory animal life, it might not need sight to find and kill him. Moving slowly, he headed away from the looming wall. He didn't want to take the chance there were sensors or doors where, despite whatever rules were in play, his hunters might pop out and grab him. If he were in charge of the cops of this world, he might not always follow the rules, especially if the stakes were high. Of course, he didn't know what they thought he was. A facet gone mad? A Miskor agent among the Sarmak? A spy for the real humans? Or maybe they were just going by a script for when anything deviated from their weird programmed scenarios. After several hundred meters of slow, cautious travel, Straker broke out of the woods to see a small clearing. At least he thought it was a clearing, until he stepped ankle-deep into the water and realized it was not flat ground but a large pond. Thirst seized him then, and a desire to wash his oozing injuries. After taking a long look around for dangers, he sank to his knees and smelled the water. It seemed fresh. Besides, his biotech and his genetically engineered immune system should keep him safe from all ordinary diseases. He drank and washed on the tiny sandy beach. The chill water soothed his scrapes, and he tore his tattered tunic and the bottoms of his trousers off to wrap his hands and arms in makeshift bandages, leaving him in nothing but crude shorts and boots. He used strips of cloth to bind up his ribs tight, making his breathing less painful. Then he took the strut in one hand as a club and circled the pond. A faint trail beckoned him, a slash in the vegetation he could barely see as his eyes adjusted. He followed it, wary, for several kilometers. Night creatures rustled. Birds called. Other noises passed that he couldn't identify. He was no woodsman, and his outdoor survival training was long behind him. Then came an unmistakable sound. A scream. A woman's scream. Straker increased his pace, seeing a glow ahead. The scream sounded again. He burst out of the woods to a hellish scene. Four enormous crimson men stood near a bonfire. Its light revealed the figure of a proportionally large woman, her hands bound above her head to a tree limb, her feet barely touching the ground. One man, laughing, brushed the woman with a burning torch, and she screamed again and kicked out in fear and rage. Straker charged. Chapter 13. Engels aboard Indomitable, Calypso System.
"I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop," said Admiral Braga to Admiral Engels as they ate off fine china in Indomitable's flag dining room. The two admirals faced each other at one end of the long table. Verdura and Jolin, Dexon and Zaxby, and several other senior officers from both sides ranged down the rest of it. This formal dinner was also an important meeting. For the last 3 days, Braga's surrounded fleet had hung in space, awaiting annihilation. Time had run out. He had to commit to a decision. Fight, surrender, or defect. Braga went on.
"You've spent 3 days showing me around your fleet, and all the evidence supports your claims. But,"
Engels smiled at her stiff-necked old commander, "but it's hard to accept that something you've believed your whole life is false. It's human nature to cling to preconceived notions, even when confronted with overwhelming evidence to the contrary if it doesn't fit your worldview. At least you didn't have to be sent to a prison camp and be beaten half to death."
"If you weren't sitting in front of me in an admiral's uniform, obviously in command, I'd wonder if they'd broken your mind and reprogrammed you. It's easy enough if your brain chips get hacked. But this whole fleet, this whole situation, can't be some kind of theater. And I've run all the usual tests to make sure I'm not inside a VR sim. So, I have to believe you."
"But you don't want to."
"I didn't. But if I accept your bizarre tale, I find myself wanting to believe it all."
Engels sipped her calf. "What's stopping you?"
"Loyalty to the Hundred Worlds, I suppose. I swore an oath."
"To what?"
"Beg pardon?"
"Specifically, to what did you swear that oath?" Braga frowned and straightened his silverware next to his half-eaten meal, not meeting her eyes.
"I understand your point, young lady. I swore an oath to the Constitution, the citizens, and the duly elected and appointed officials of the Hundred Worlds, in that order. You're going to argue my duty to the Constitution means I have a higher duty, to the truth, to the law that's obviously been violated at many levels, and to the long-term interests of the citizenry."
"Sounds like you're making your own argument."
"But if it were that simple, military people would be changing sides every time their own government got out of line. We can't ignore Parliament and the chain of command just because we don't like what they're doing. I need to know the Constitution's being violated so thoroughly and irretrievably that the concept of treason becomes moot."
"I've studied the Hundred Worlds Constitution," Engels said earnestly. "Part of Article 1 states, 'The government shall in all things be truthful and forthright, with the usual exceptions for military necessity and classified information.' Do you think the government has been truthful and forthright?"
"An argument could be made that—"
"Come on, Lucas. You know the answer. You simply need to decide if all the lies they told you rise to the level of unjustly abrogating the Constitution. If so, the politicians committed treason, not you. And you're free of your oath."
You can't be faithful to a lie.
I can be faithful to the spirit of truth. Braga folded his hands and lifted his gaze to Engels. That's why I've decided to surrender.
Not defect?
You'll have our ships. You mousetrapped us fair and square. I've ordered no sabotage. That's the payment for my people's lives. But I can't turn around and fight against the 100 worlds. It's a personal decision, and it's final.
Engels sighed. I'm sorry to hear that, but I understand.
Since my decision was a personal one, Braga continued, I'll make an announcement to my captains and crews, giving them leave to make the same decision. They can be interned with me, or they may choose to join your republic. I've allowed them to see records of all the evidence.
That's very fair of you. Though, of course, you could hardly stop them from defecting.
This way their consciences are clear if they do.
And in your heart of hearts, you want us to win? Braga sat stiffly and lowered his eyes again.
I didn't say that.
Engels nodded sharply. Of course not. I'll stay with you, Captain Verdura said, reaching out to lay her palm on Braga's arm.
Thank you, Lydia. But that won't be necessary.
I think it is. You made a personal decision for everyone under your command, no?
So I did.
Braga concentrated on finishing his meal and said no more. Later, in his amazingly spacious assigned quarters aboard Indomitable, he held his sidearm in his hands and stared at it for long minutes. He was surprised when Engels allowed him to keep it, fully charged, though an honor guard of 4 Marines attended him everywhere. She must still be hoping he'd change his mind, and was treating him like a guest instead of a prisoner. But there was no guard here, only he and his weapon. Less than a kilogram, but it could end his life and his shame with one easy pull of the trigger. Is that what his life had come to? 33 years of distinguished service, capped by a military disaster, and then he didn't even have the guts to ask his people to die with him in a blaze of glory. Yet he couldn't do it. If he thought a final stand would change the course of the war, would inspire a victory of right and righteousness, he'd have done it, fighting to the death merely that Admiral Lucas Braga not have to face another personal defeat. That would be the true coward's way. And he didn't know which side was right. He used to be sure. But now he saw those at the top of the 100 worlds had supplied fake certainty. Not only had they figuratively demonized the enemy, common propaganda during most wars throughout history, they'd done it more literally, twisting the truth until everyone believed the Hawk shock troops were demonic alien invaders, instead of dissidents and criminals turned into soulless war slaves. Why? Did his leaders believe people would work or fight less hard against humans? Or was it simply about keeping control, pumping up war fever and blind hatred? But there were alien invaders, the Opters. A dozen races of aliens lived in relative peace with humans. Some, like the Ruxans, even integrated themselves into the forces of both sides. But these insectoids, if Zaxby's briefings were accurate, they'd been perverting human history for centuries. Those were the ones humans should be angry with. Even if there were some good Opters, their regime had attacked humans unprovoked, murdering millions. Worse, they'd perpetuated a civil war that had killed billions and kept humanity divided and weakened. And that was ultimately why Braga didn't put the muzzle of his pistol in his mouth and let a beam of coherent light boil his brain.
He couldn't bring himself to lead others against the Hundred Worlds. But if the time ever came to go to war against the Opters, perhaps he'd be needed. Admiral Engels busied herself with the overwhelming detail of reorganizing her fleet. She triaged her forces, sending severely damaged ships that nevertheless had working sidespace drives straight to Murmorsk for repair and refit. Before they left, she cannibalized all their supplies and filled them with prisoners of war, those who hadn't wished to defect, including Braga, Verdura, and all of the Hun ship captains. Those, likely, were swayed by Braga's example, but she didn't let it worry her. None of them would have been trusted with command of a ship anyway. The split between defectors and internees turned out to be about 50-50 once the lower-ranking detainees had been processed and given free choice. That gave her thousands of trained and experienced spacers to sprinkle throughout her fleet. Her two new carriers she filled to bursting with extra stocks of everything and designated them as fleet auxiliaries. She ordered each of her ships to give up a small craft or two and transfer them to the carriers as well. By this method, she created a true expeditionary force, a fleet in being to give her enemies pause. Hun spy drones were no doubt even now tunneling through side space with reports of the loss of Braga's 10th Fleet, but she'd been careful to keep an assembled Indomitable hidden in the gas. When the battleship emerged, she would be seen as 16 oddly shaped super dreadnoughts, and Engels had also taken deception measures to hide how many of Braga's ships she'd taken intact. All told, she now had more than 300 warships, over 100 of them of capital grade, one of the largest armadas ever assembled in one place. Indomitable herself was worth roughly another 50, if she could get into the fight. The fleet's very presence would make the Huns change their strategy. They would combine task forces into larger fleets, and they would slow their headlong rush to seize Republic territory. They'd scout more, trying to ensure they didn't get trapped again, and they'd seek a way to combine on her and bring her to battle. Of all this, she was as certain as any commander could be. The Huns had taken a stunning tactical loss, but not a crippling strategic one. She sent Benota a complete report via message drone and asked that the next communique to the Hundred Worlds Parliament reference the situation. Maybe it would get them to start talking. However, Engels had to plan for the worst. She had to assume one bloody nose wouldn't do it, and that meant she had to secure another victory, to deal the enemy a blow to their morale and will to fight. The Huns wouldn't be suckered again like at Calypso. Besides, there was no place so suitable. Ambushing a force in space was difficult. Instead, she needed to employ a more conventional strategy of forcing the enemy to defend something valuable. That ruled out any of the newly taken systems. No. Her model needed to be the battle where it all started, where Braga had also tasted defeat, and she herself had been captured. Corinth. There, the mutuality had driven deep into Hun territory and pillaged a heavily industrialized world. They'd hidden their strength and waited for the relieving forces to rush in, as they'd hoped. Then they'd handed Braga and the Hundred Worlds Navy their asses. If it worked once, why not again? Only this time, the full load of supplies would allow her forces to choose an enemy system beyond their supposed travel range. The question was, which one? She examined the entire war front and the enemy worlds behind it, with Trinity comm-linked in to run the conference room holo table. Her staff attended, but the tripart being was so efficient that they were hardly needed. Many good choices presented themselves, but she kept coming back to one. Sparta. While not the most heavily industrialized or populated system, it contained one unique thing, a a sprawling manufacturing complex of the Carstairs Corporation. There, mech suit technology was researched and developed, and over 90% of the Hun suits were built on site. If she could capture and strip the factories and laboratories, the enemy would be set back years, and the Republic would come much closer to ground force parity. Sparta was also an easy stepping stone to the Huns' political heart, the capital system of Atlantis. Taking it would force the fleets driving into the Republic to turn around to deal with this new threat. As with Calypso, she would hide her true strength until it was too late. If she won the first battle when they counterattacked, she might even be able to hold the system for months, forcing the Hundred Worlds to pull back and regroup all along the front. If so, their parliament would have to negotiate a truce, the first step toward making peace, ending the civil war, and dealing with the Opter threat. Was she being tempted beyond good sense? Lots of commanders throughout history had thrown the dice one too many times. But all the analysis said that she had a good chance to pull it off at each stage. The first battle, the attack, would be easy. Her entire fleet dropping out of side space so deep in enemy territory. Sims of the second counterattacking battle showed about a 75% likelihood of winning against even the worst-case estimates of Hundred World strength. 3 out of 4 chances. Was that good enough? For a simple battle over a star system, perhaps not, especially as failure would be far worse for her so deep in their territory than for the Huns. But in reality, this battle might be for the fate of humanity. For that, it seemed worth the risk. Carla wished Derek were here. His 2 to 3 month estimate was a double-edged sword. It gave her time to prepare her campaign, but it also meant he wouldn't be with her at the critical time. She had no doubts about her own tactical ability, and her captains and crews would perform well now that they'd won this great victory. But having the Liberator with them would be worth a squadron or more just for the morale boost. And she was honest enough to admit to herself, Derek had a way of seeing things from a fresh perspective and finding a better way to win, not to mention that she already missed him. In the silence of her 2 large flag quarters, in the emptiness of their bed, the demons of doubt crept in. Was he coming back? Was he even still alive? If anyone could pull off the mission he'd set himself, Derek Straker could. Still, at times, she could barely restrain her anger at his leaving. His place was at her side, and vice versa, not playing spy among aliens. So, settling on Sparta, she ordered her fleet, designated 1st Expeditionary Force, to prepare and plan in detail. Her message drones had requested additional ground forces in particular, whatever Benota could spare. After 6 days, return courier drones arrived with word that the Huns still weren't talking, despite new overtures stressing their disaster at Calypso, the Republic's willingness to talk, and the threat posed by the Opters.
I'm beginning to suspect the Opter influence goes deeper than we feared, Benota said in a recorded eyes-only vid. We've developed a test for Opter genetics and biotech, and while it's far from perfect, it's identified thousands of possible agents among us at every level. The security and intelligence services are working overtime, looking for evidence against these suspects. And in the meantime, they're being watched and assigned to less sensitive duties. The vid continued. That makes my denial of your request for ground forces all the more painful for me, given your impressive victory. I always want to reinforce success, not failure. However, these spies among us and unrest among our frightened populace mean we need every hawk, every marine, every breaker, and trustworthy soldier or police officer of any kind. There's even been a proposal to kill two birds with one stone.